Okay, if you didn't hear that, it's geared toward the prince's future rulers. Yeah, that it is. I mean, I don't think anybody denies this is a book basically aimed at young men who are going to be the administrators. We'll keep going. What else would you say? Okay, yeah, it's a layered book. It's really a textured book. And there are a few people who want to defend Solomon's authorship beginning to end. But it's pretty obvious from the book itself that it isn't that way. Other writers are introduced. And he was not only a composer of Proverbs, but he was also a collector of Proverbs. And the book of Proverbs is clearly assembled after Solomon's time. Because we have the Proverbs collected by the men of Hezekiah, for example, that show up in 25. We know this is close to 300 years after the time of Solomon. And so whatever the original form of this book is, it's kind of a moving target for us historically. Okay, so we've got it written for the courtier administration class. We've got a layered book of a collection of Proverbs. What else might you say?
Read it thoughtfully if you're a woman.
Read it thoughtfully if you're a woman. Yes. Read it thoughtfully if you're a woman. There would be things that if you looked at them and took them crassly, you would say, that's almost misogynistic, you know the word I mean. It almost hates women. But I thought, no, it's not. The picture of a wise woman is, in fact, the picture of wisdom. And it's not as if the contrast in the beginning of the book is between a man and a woman, like the woman's the floozy across the street, the painted temptress, and over here is a male figure. No, over here is the beautiful woman, wisdom. So I think that balances it right away. It says, look at this thoughtfully. It might not, you might miss that. Anything else? Well, we haven't said anything about what it's about really yet. If you had to say, well, what's that book about? Words to live by. I think that's the intriguing thing about it. We tend to think of it as a collection of sort of Proverbs proper, these pithy little 2 and 4 line things. They're kind of assembled at random, ranging over a wide very subject, but to try to bring them all together and summarize them would be really hard to do. So, well, there are those proverbs there, but there's much more to it. But if you had to say it's all about something, I'd have to say it's probably all about successful living, successful in the spiritual sense of the word. I mean, there's nothing crass about it. How to conduct yourself in the Lord, in faith, that is most likely to lead to success, most likely to avoid self-defeat and self-destructive actions. How to administer. It's very sensitive about power relationships, and it is about administration. You think, well, how do you read it then if you're not really an administrator?
Well, it's good for just self-conduct, how you're to live in your own home. And actually, we're all administrators of something. Mm-hmm. You might be an administrator, 1855 Susan Lang Trail.
That's who lives there?
That's where Betty Jo and I co-administer.
Oh, you are Alexander the Great in that realm. You are the queen of that realm. There.
And Murray bows down to us.
These are pets, by the way. These are two inside jokes here. Well, that's true. I mean, everybody, in a sense, I think, does administer. They work in administration somewhere. And even those who don't feel very consciously like they've got a lot to manipulate there, everybody is under authority. And I think in many ways, we look at some of the things that are in Proverbs and we say, it helps us diagnose the situation, see what's really there. And that's what's so interesting about it. So often it's saying, look at this situation, and the proverb tells us what's really going on there, what might really be going on. diagnose the situation. This is 3,000 years ago, you know, a lot of this. I mean, you think, it's psychologically rich. It looks on the inside of motive and character and talks about what's making people tick, perhaps. There are different approaches in the Proverbs. I said some of them are the pithy little Proverbs, but some of them are lengthier and developed more narrative, if you might say. They just draw out a little bit more. Now, today we want to go to a different set of it, Yent. This is our next to last one. This is yet another collection of Proverbs collected into the books. And why don't we start by just having somebody read for us chapter 30, verse 1. And you've got names there. Don't worry about it. Sin boldly when you pronounce the names. Pause and belt it out. And if who's to correct you? Because I'm telling you, nobody knows how to pronounce these names. I'm serious about that, though, because we don't know really what language they're even being drawn from. So, 31. 30, verse 1.
The sayings of Agur, son of Jakai, an inspired utterance. This man's utterance to Ithiel, I am weary, God, but I can prevail. How many verses?
That's it. What translation?
NIV.
Anybody got a different translation? Want to belt this one out?
What would you like?
It says NIV.
Well, last time when Bob was reading off a phone like this, it was like gave you the wrong chapter and verse, didn't it?
Yeah, I got it corrected now.
Okay. Well, any translation will be fine. What we're going to find is they're very, very much. They're very different from one another.
Here's the Amplified. The words of Agur, son of Jakai, of Massa, the man says to Ithiel to Ukal.
Oh, okay. That's it? I'm sorry.
Verse 1.
Yeah, okay. I don't know what you have there, but you might have different things. The question is, to what extent are these names and to what extent are they types that describe something or other? For example, a lot of people saw that these weren't persons, but kind of figures, and that the names had a significance, and they tried to draw them out of Hebrew for the most part and say, well, what is it really saying? So, for example, the Vulgate. You familiar with the Vulgate? This is the early Latin scriptures. This was the scriptures of the Middle Ages of the Catholic Church translated in Latin. Well, we're going to render it back into English, and it says, the words of the collector, the son of the vomiter, the vision of the man who has God with him. The son of the vomiter. And you all know what a vomiter is. You think, what on earth is that about? And, it gets drawn out of the Agadah, which is the Talmud is this old document. It'll tell you all about the Jewish faith coming from about the early part of the Christian era for the first few hundred years. And they said, they get it too. Agur, the king here, apparently, the words of Agur, son of Jakai. Agur meant the compiler. That can be drawn out. Hebrew's tricky. It says, the one who spat out. And so, who is Agur? Well, they were saying, well, he's a son of Solomon. And who is Jakai? Solomon himself. What did he spit out? Well, according to some of the old rabbinic tradition, what he spat out was the advice that you shouldn't draw for yourself many wives if you were a king, because they will lead your heart astray. So the vomiter, the spitter outer here, was seen to be, in the Talmud, Solomon himself. He disregarded the advice that was to be given to him. So what's this leave us with? A lot of uncertainty as to who exactly is at stake here. Most people don't buy the Talmud or the Latin there on that as exactly what's going on. It was an attempt to draw from the words meaning and project them back into the time. When you get to a lot of commentators will say, no, I think these are really just guys. That Agur would be the one who collected them from Jake, and then he declared them to his two pupils, Ithiel and Ukal. And you may find those translated different ways. So that's exciting, isn't it?
Oh,
what, they're identified as what?
It says, "I am weary, God. I'm weary and spent.
And I'm trying to remember. They draw those out of the same consonants. Hebrew is tricky to translate. You probably noticed this, like poetic Hebrew. Like if you're in a Bible study and people are reading the Proverbs or the Psalms or the Song of Solomon or Ecclesiastes, translations can vary wildly. Job is another one. It was so tricky to translate, as I understand it, that when the early Bible translators in the book of Job tried to translate the Hebrew into the Greek, they just left 40 verses untranslated and just came back to, can't do it. Can't be done. We don't know what it's about. so they just left it that way. This is why we say that is the Word of God without error in its original manuscripts. Because translation's a human problem, and you can run into some that are thorny. Okay, well, let's read. This is clearly a different kind of chapter, a different collection of Proverbs. And let's break them into a couple of chunks here. And why don't we go with, somebody just read us 32 through 6. Okay. Now I find in this, and of course it's not easy to say, well, where are the boundaries here in one section of this? What goes with what here? So the verses aren't a part of the versification. The English isn't part of the original language. So you have to say, where do you cut it off? Where do you put your markers here? I put this all together, and it came up with. The best I could with this. Now, we'll see. Maybe we should just jump to it at the very beginning. Verse 4, have you ever seen that before anywhere?
Job, it sounds like Job.
In verse 4?
Well, the whole question.
Now, I thought Job a lot with those questions, because you have all those, and remember, we're in the world of wisdom literature, and Job's included here, but all those questions, right, that God puts to Job that leave him so speechless. You tell me if you know all this stuff. And, of course, Job is left silent. He simply doesn't know enough to bring a charge against God's justice or fairness is the midst of that. But do you recognize anything else there? In 4, in particular.
Did you talk about it earlier in Proverbs?
No.
Sounds like Paul talking about Jesus.
Ah, yes. There is something here. This is the big word for this is what? Intertextuality. Texts that talk to texts. In other words, one book talks to the other book. You ever heard that term? It's a real interesting one, how things talk back and forth. Now, they don't always, not everybody knows they're talking back and forth, but they end up talking back and forth by reference. Now, one of the places we're talking to or from here would actually be Psalm 68, if you wouldn't mind turning there. And when somebody gets to Psalm 68, would you read us verses 17 and 18?
Sinai into the sanctuary. When you ascended on high, you led captives in your train, you received gifts from men, even from the rebellious, that you will work God with you.
Okay. Now, weird thing about intertextuality here is sometimes the context get played with. Now, we've seen this. This seems very much like what we just said. Who has ascended on high, right? We're looking at 4 in Proverbs. Who has descended into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fist? And often, if you have a cross-reference here, people are going back to Psalms. Oh, this language seems so close. You have ascended on high. You have led captivity captive. You have received gifts from among men. Now, where might you see some other book talking to book there? Ah, yes. And that's another one that comes from. It might be the patriarch of them all, or matriarch. I'll leave it up to you. But it's the original verses. This word that God gives you isn't so far from you. It's right here. No one has to go up to heaven to grab it. You don't have to go down to get it. It's here right in front of you. And that's the Deuteronomy passage. It's not past you. It's not a mystery. But I'm still thinking of yet another verse in the new set of verses in the New Testament. What is it? Yeah, do you have it? Do you have it pulled up there? What's it say? Yep, very good. This is a direct quotation, right? And what does it mean that he ascended, but that he also first descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens that he might fill all things. Oh, what do you think? We got some intertextuality going on here? Well, that's the question, right? What do you think? That's the question. I think there is a unifying idea that makes this image work in all these cases. But let's back up now. What's our first, say, we've got this proverbial chunk here, and we say in verse 2, where do we start in verse 2? Yeah. What's our understanding like? Yeah. Surely I am more stupid than any man. That's why some people don't think Solomon's behind this. I mean, it doesn't fit his biographical profile, does it? But so, surely I am more stupid than any man. I do not have the understanding of a man. The idea is you're below ground zero. Your understanding, your natural understanding, your natural knowledge is animalistic, right? It's just not, there's not much to it. And what's the problem in verse 3? Yeah, I haven't gotten anything from heaven, right? I lack wisdom. I neither learned wisdom nor have any knowledge of the Holy One. Now I'm thinking, speaking of as a proverbial chunk, this is our condition. Our condition of natural knowledge about things leaves us in a terrible dilemma. It's not sufficient. It doesn't fulfill our need. And then we look at verse 4 and we say, what might be our answer? Or maybe it's just continued to be part of the problem. But it's just elaborated. Where is it to be had, what I need? In heaven, right. I mean, I sense that my natural knowledge of the world is just deficient. I mean, what I've got naturally is not enough. I sense that it's up there, but who could go up and get it for me? Who could bring it back? And saying, well, I'm left in the same position Job is, just agnostic. I say, I don't know. I don't know who gathered the wind in his fists. I don't know who established the ends of the earth. And then you get that cryptic, messianic statement about his son's name, you wonder, do we see Jesus there? I mean, I can't help but see Jesus there. I mean, I'm sure that a Jew 1,000 years before the time of Christ didn't think in terms of a Trinitarian God with a son. So I'm not sure how that Jew interpreted it. But when I look back at it as a Christian, I think, wow, what's that about? Yeah. Right. Well, that's to me, certainly. I mean, I think that to Paul, certainly. How does Paul take the same imagery? Say, well, there's a barrier here. I mean, our understanding, our wisdom, our physics, our philosophy just don't go there. But how do you get real data? We have somebody who descended and ascends again. I mean, there is a nexus, a connection there that can provide what we don't have. And I would say, but could a Jew have understood that before the time of Christ, especially this far ahead of the time of Christ? I'd say that's way beyond anything they would have imagined.
Would they have started talking about Messiah?
Possibly. They would have talked about a prophet after the manner of Moses, so one raised up to who would do it. But the idea of dividing God's character, giving God a son, would have been just blasphemous to them. I mean, God is one. All right, so you've got this, our natural condition's bad, wisdom is apparently transcendent and heavenly, but how on earth do you access it then? Wait 1,000 years for it to unfold? That's not likely if you're writing a book to an administrative class 1,000 years before the time of Christ. Where might you find it, and where do we look here? How about the next verse? All right, so where do you find it? All right, yeah. And now, the Word of God then, of course, is a different quantity, right? I mean, we have these Bibles. I mean, they didn't have Bibles. Well, yeah, a lot of it was taught. What exactly was written and compiled at this point in terms of what we even think of as the Hebrew Scriptures is kind of vague to us. I mean, the books of Moses are probably kicking around. A lot of the Psalms are probably kicking around. But what else is in the collection is really hard to say at this point. That's what makes Old Testament study so interesting. We don't really know what the original forms were or how they were compiled, because obviously it's a work in progress that's still being developed. So depending on how far back you go, I don't know. I mean, it might well be before the time of Isaiah, Jeremiah, or the 8th century prophets. We don't know. But we do know whatever it is, however we get it, the Word of God is pure and a shield to those who put their trust in Him. But then instantly a caution arises. And what is that? Don't mess with it. Don't invent it. Because it's so easy if you're administering to paste God's name onto what you're doing or let your imagination run wild with you. But it appears here, isn't it interesting that it's not the deletion or ignoring of God's word that gets you into trouble? It's what? Adding it to it. It's signing God's name on things that God's name doesn't go on. Would that ever happen in our time period? For example, yeah, I agree. Yeah, God, this is taking the Lord's name in vain. I mean, we sign God's name to things that He hasn't put His signature on, you know, and usually it's to make our case better against everyone else's. I mean, who's God approve of? Us. Who wins the war? Our side, of course. We'll sign God's name on anything. And you'd think, well, in this context, that would be very... You know, you want to rally the people, want to administer. I say, God tells you to do this. And they say, don't do this. You know, you're going out, you know, to rule and administer. Don't start putting God's name on things you don't know that God's name belongs on. Don't add to his words, lest he rebuke you and you be found a liar. Okay, so that's one little chunk I found that was pretty interesting. And I'd like to jump to another one here. Now, I think it sort of serves as a sample of some of the ones we have to delete. But let's look at verse 11 through 14. Can somebody get that and read it for us? Okay. By the way, those who curse them, I remember somebody told me, I think they told me, or at least they indicated to me, the message got across, it was the worst Mother's Day sermon they'd ever heard, but I was using that, and then you get to verse 17, the eye that mocks his father and scorns obedience of his mothers, the ravens of the valley will pick it out, and the young eagles will eat it. It just didn't have enough hearts and flowers in it for Mother's Day, I guess. What can I say? You know, you should not be made a minister when you're 33 years old. That's all I can say about that. You know? It tended to be that way. Dorothy just went ahead to that. I love that proverb. I'm not quite sure how to fit it into the rest of the idea. The leech has two daughters. Give and give. There's so much you have to leave uncovered in this, but that's always been one of my favorites, one of the real humorous ones. All right, well, we've got this generations. Does anybody else have something else going on there? Let's say, there is a generation that this, there is a generation that that. Does anybody have a different set of words going there? Yeah, there is a kind of person. The word is generation. I don't know, but what do you mean when you say generation? Do you think of it in terms of a successive rolling? Well, there's one generation, you know, a Pepsi generation, and there's a greatest generation and an American dream generation. They kind of follow one another in chronological order. Do you think it's suggesting that? Yeah, a lot of them do that. The word generations in there. So it's a question of how do you, I mean, it's in the original, it's in the Hebrew, but it's what do you do with it, or how do you render it so it doesn't mislead? There are generational studies that are really interesting. I remember reading about wealth somewhere that there's at least some truth sociologically that you have accumulators, managers, squanderers that follow one another. You know, one guy accumulates all the money and the next generation kind of administers it well, and then the next generation's grown up in enough affluence that they just give it away. I have this sinking feeling every time I say that I know which generation I'm in and I'm dropping the ball. Actually, I should be an accumulator and I'm not accumulating that much, so maybe some of these things skip a generation. But what do you think? Should you think of it as just chunks of people, characteristics of groups of people, or should you think of it chronologically? Well, all right. Hold that question. Anybody else want to add? Why did you answer a question with a question? And then you say, why are you asking me if I should answer a question?
I think there's people in every generation that do that.
Undoubtedly. Why do you suppose it's in here? Let me answer your question to my question with a question. Since yours is a good question, what? Why would it be here?
Well, if you start at the last verse, which ends up with them devouring the poor from the earth, it almost, I think if you read it from that verse and go backwards, what it is an explanation of who's the kind of person who would do that.
Okay. So it starts as a progression, disregarding its mother and father, becoming self-righteous.
They're pure in their own eyes. What they're doing is right. Is it some sort of cycle?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Yeah, I wonder. Does it cycle? I don't know is my answer on this. But one thing I'm thinking about here is that if you were teaching the class of people we're talking about here, is that you will find yourself in certain circumstances, and you should perhaps be honest about where you've landed. In other words, we send you out to West Jefferson or, you know, wherever it is. You know, that's your administrative category. Maybe the guy before you had a great assignment, a peach of a job, but you're being dropped into a set of circumstances, and not to be surprised, because there are these groups out there. There are people that curse their mother and father. There are people who are pure in their own eyes but are not washed from filthiness. There are people who are lofty in their eyes. There's a generation then that are just vicious. Their teeth are like swords and whose fangs are like knives. That you can find yourself in this. This is the human condition. And you can easily find yourself in that cluster. And what would it be of value to you to pretend that these weren't the possible circumstances that you were facing? What do you think? Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I think everybody's at a loss as to who's writing this when and under what circumstances. I'm asking that question, why is it here? I mean, what would it profit you to know this? And I'm thinking, well, it wouldn't matter if it were generational in a sense, if it cycled this way. It wouldn't even really particularly matter if it was a progression even in a lifetime. Or a cyclical kind of thing that spawns it. But what would matter is you can find yourself here in the generation, among those that. And
it's a warning about what you think is harmless.
Mm.
So you think cursing their fathers and not blessing their mothers, you know, you can find some people who are like that, right, without looking too far.
I'm thinking Vicki and Colleen and you are all thinking of this in those kind of progressive terms. I hadn't thought of it in that way. I thought about it about honesty in my situation. And then I was going to ask I don't know. I mean, you could be right here. I don't think there's a final answer here, but
I just think of it as more of a knowledge, a warning to that you'll run into these people. While you're leading, that people will think they're honest when you may see that they're not, and they may just not think that way, and just a warning about when you're leading, you're going to be leading these people.
That's the wavelength I was on, and since you don't really know what happens with those who curse their mother and father, you would have to tag 17 in there to my Mother's Day sermon. Say that's a disaster. When you see it, expect ruin. If you find yourself working in that context. So, what context do we live in, by the way? This morning, are we in any of these generations?
I'd say there's a fair amount of poor being devoured from the earth.
If you're
not really recognizing the ferocity behind it.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's an intriguing question to me. I mean, do any of these in particular characterize our time and place? And I don't know that I have an answer to that. I mean, I think if you wake up surly and crabby, you might say they all apply to us. If you're waking up feeling cheerful and confident and feeling good about yourself, you might say, no, this doesn't apply to us this morning. But I'd say, generally speaking, if I think where do we stand in the history of the human race, our teeth are like swords and our fangs are like knives. I mean, I just say we live in a very violent world. It learns to sanitize its violence and kind of keep at least some people immune from it. I think this is a brutal time period. That's my guess, but you can run with it the way you want. Let's look at a few other clusters here. He has several of them, and these are things in threes and fours. And it's an interesting device he uses rhetorically to develop this. So we've got, sets of five things that are listed as being in threes and fours. So let's see what we've got here. We're in 15 and 16, right after the leech's two daughters, but let's leave that off there. And would you somebody read us 15 and 16?
There are three things that are never satisfied, four that never say enough: the grave, the barren womb, land, which is never satisfied with water, and fire, which never says enough.
All right, now somebody jump to 18 and 19, another list of three or four.
There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden.
That's such a beautiful piece. Verses 21 through 23. All right, 24 through 28.
There are four creatures on the earth that are small, but they are very wise and we can learn from them. While ants are hardly a strong species, they work constantly to store up food during the summer. While badgers are animals without many defenses, they are wise enough to make their homes in the rocky cliffs. While locusts live without a ruler, they all know how to move in formation. While a lizard is easy enough to catch in your hand, it is shrewd enough to enter the palace.
Very good. So now I've had four clusters. Well, that one doesn't have the three or four formula. It just gives you four things, bluntly there. And now we have one last one to look at, 29 through 31. And once again, it isn't three or four. It's three now. 29. Okay. All right, so we've got five things clustered as three and four. Three things and four. Why do you suppose somebody says three things and four? Three of them did that, then one was just four and one was just three. But why would you say three, four? Dramatic effect. But you always have a dramatic effect for a reason. But does it mean anything? I mean, why would you do that to somebody?
Pay extra attention.
All right, pay extra attention. But what would there be any power in the three and four, do you think? Any significance to it? There are three and four.
Well, they're saying two different things. There are three things that are never satisfied, four that never say enough. I mean, it's rephrased. Amazing, I do not understand.
Right. Perturbed and cannot bear up. I think it's the other three, four thing in verse 21.
Yeah.
than to go to the list of 4 and 3. Well, my guess is, I thought, why this? What does it say to us? I mean, it is a rephrasing of it, but is it saying that, all right, this is poetry, my friends. This is an exhaustive list. This is a big topic. You can nail it down to 3, but you better be ready for 4. Actually, keep moving with it. It's a dynamic concept that will have a broadening kind of power to it. I'm guessing that's what 3, even 4, say. Don't get Talmudic and mathematical about this. I'm not saying there are only 3. I'm saying there are 4. I'm saying this is a concept that's an open funnel that's just going to continue to grow. That's my interpretation. And like my old professor once said, if you have a better one, you're welcome to it. I'm sticking with mine until you give me a better one. That's what I thought. So now the question is then, what's in these things? For example, what's the satisfaction one in the first thing? These things are never satisfied. The grave, the womb, parched earth, and fire. What's the message to us? Is it just a poetic observation about the world, or is there knowledge for success here? Yeah, maybe that if you're leading these there's no final administration of these topics. They are perennial. They are unsolvable, and they're going to keep the grave. People are going to keep dying. The barren womb is a terrible pain for people who want to have children and can't. Drought, it's going to continue to suck things in, and a certain kind of natural destructive force. And fire, it'll keep eating. It'll keep going. That's how I was looking at it. If we look at 18 and 19, we say there are things that are way beyond us. An eagle in an air, a serpent on a rock, a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a virgin. What are we talking about there? Do you think? What's the wisdom? I go with that. Anybody want to push it out any further? I like the eagle's in the air soaring, but a snake on a rock bathing is I mean, you could, you know, just out. I mean, you've seen it, right? That's a big thing in California. You still have like things like around my mom's place, like rattlesnakes will come out on the sidewalks. You know, they're like warnings at public places near my mom's place. Like, you know, watch out for rattlesnakes in the morning. They'll come out on the warm pavement and just lie there, and you step right on them. It's true. They're there. Well, that's like such a contrast. The one's poisonous and inert. The one's not dangerous to us, but soaring and glorious. And a ship in the midst of the sea is subject to powers that are just overwhelming. I mean, I've only been in little sea storms on lakes and things, but I imagine being out in the pitching ocean would be quite an experience. And then the last one, which is way past anybody's understanding, what's that? That's the womanly interpretation you were talking about earlier. I was thinking, what did he see in her? We're such chumps. I mean, I've said that. Rob said that just a couple other weeks ago. We're susceptible. I don't know. What do you think? Is it the most mysterious thing in that list? What's that? Well, I think it's fair. Yeah. Is there? But once again, if you're leading that these things, expect to be surprised. Expect to find saying, I don't know. Why did he do that? Well, he was in love. You know, what can I say? Men do stupid things for the women they love. All right, there you go. Then if you follow it though, the way of an adulterous woman, I've done nothing wrong. All right, so we have then three things that perturb the earth and it can't bear up. A servant when he reigns. Why? Because the servant has a vendetta, right? He's got a score to settle. A fool when he is filled with food. Give a fool prosperity, the tools, the satiation to rule, and think of the damage they can do. A hateful woman when she is married, or a hated woman when she is married. What are we saying there? Well, and the whole world's perturbed. It just can't bear up under the pain of this.
I was thinking of the story of Rachel and Leah.
Leah, I thought of Leah. Does it lead to some extra discussion? Well, we're kind of running out of time here. I love the idea, though, of the little things that do great. Ants, rock badgers, locusts, and spiders. And I think clearly he's giving wisdom to somebody that these small efforts are actually incredibly powerful. If you can, in a sense, get in front of this or administer this way, you are in not to always be impressed with mighty armies and big actions, that these things are in fact strong. And then think a lion, a greyhound, a male goat, and a king. So what are we saying there? Well, I'd say how to present yourself and how to understand other people who are presenting themselves. Expect them to be stately, a king with his army. But also, I think you're saying how do you go out and do your task if you want a model. These things are stately: a lion, a greyhound, and a male goat, and a king with his army. This is how you get your kids ready for school, Lisa. You know, this. This is presence, right? The value of presence for a leader. Very important at times. At times it's not, but at times there's a time to imitate. One more of these. One more lesson on Proverbs. Thanks for coming. I'll dispense with prayer and stuff like that. May the Lord bless you. See you next week.